Welcome back to another episode of The Adam Paradox. Today we are talking about John Lennox, who is a professor of mathematics at the University of Oxford and a fellow in mathematics at the Philosophy of Science at Green Templeton College in Oxford. And he is also an associate fellow of the said business school, Oxford University, and teaches for the Oxford Strategic Leadership Program. In addition, he is an adjunct lecturer at Wycliffe Hall, Oxford University, and the Oxford Center for Christian Apologetics, as well as being a senior fellow of the Trinity Forum. He studied at the Royal School, Armagh, Northern Ireland, and was an exhibitioner and senior scholar at Emmanuel College, Cambridge University, from which he took his MA, math and PhD. He worked for many years in the Mathematics Institute at the University of Wales in Cardiff, which awarded him a DSc, I have no idea what that means, for his research. He also holds an MA and DPhil from Oxford University and MA in bioethics from the University of Surrey, I guess. He was a senior Alexander von Humboldt Fellow at the Universities of Würzburg and Freiburg in Germany. He's also debated people like Richard Dawkins from The God Delusion, the University of Alabama in 2007, and on Has Science Buried God in the Oxford Museum of Natural History 2008. He has also debated Christopher Hitchens on the New Atheism Edinburgh Festival 2008 and the question of Is God Great by Stanford University in 2010, as well as Peter Singer on the topic of Is There a God, Melbourne 2011. Furthermore, he has participated in public discussions on similar topics with many other academics on campuses around the world. So this particular clip we're going to be listening to is from a YouTube channel, and it's titled Professor John Lennox, God Does Exist. Does is all in caps. And it has over 390,000 views. So we're going to be looking at this and just see what he has to say. This was an address to a room full of people. And there was probably, I mean, easily like 100 people in this room, or at least 60 to 100, all wearing suits, bow ties, taking notes and everything. And some of the things kind of struck me as odd or interesting. And I haven't really heard much of John Lennox. But he's been on stage with some other ones that I have heard from. Chopra is one of them. I can't remember his first name. He's the Indian guy that believes in reincarnation or something. I might have that wrong. But anyways, they were on the same stage. I heard him. And now I am finally finding some of his work to refute or critique. So we'll see where it goes. And let's take a listen.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. I believe in God. I believe in the supernatural God who created the heavens and the earth. I believe in a God who holds the heavens and the earth in existence. I believe that on the basis of rational evidence, similar to the beliefs held by the founders of this house, who gave this university the motto, Dominus Illuminatio Mea. They saw no contradiction between faith in God and the utmost excellence in rational inquiry. And if I dare mention my alma mater of Cambridge in this holy place, I would remind you that on the door of the Cavendish Laboratory in Cambridge are written the words, "Great are the works of the Lord, studied by all who delight in them." And as we look at the rise of science in the 16th and 17th centuries, Alfred North Whitehead and many others commented that men became scientific because they expected law in nature, and they expected law in nature because they believed in a lawgiver. So, ladies and gentlemen, I'm not ashamed of being both a scientist and a Christian, because arguably Christianity gave me my subject. What I am amazed at is that serious thinkers today continue to ask us to choose between God and science. That's like asking people to choose between Henry Ford and engineering as an explanation of the motor car. When Newton discovered his law of gravity, he didn't say, "I've got a law, I don't need God." No, he wrote the Principia Mathematica, arguably the greatest work in the whole history of science, because he saw that God is not the same kind of explanation as a scientific explanation. God doesn't compete. Agency does not compete with mechanism and law. Why is there something rather than nothing? Alan Sandage, the brilliant cosmologist who became a Christian in his 50s, said God is the answer to that question. But people are now so desperate to show that the universe created itself from nothing, which seems to me to be an immediate oxymoron. If I say X created Y, I'm assuming the existence of X to explain the existence of Y. If I say X created X, I'm assuming the existence of X to explain the existence of X, which simply shows that nonsense remains nonsense, even if high-powered scientists utter it. It reminds me a little bit of G.K. Chesterton, who said, "It is absurd to complain that it is unthinkable for an unthinkable God to make everything out of nothing, and then to pretend that it is more thinkable that nothing should turn itself into everything." The heavens declare the glory of God, says the ancient psalm. And we've unraveled a bit of that, seeing the fine-tuning of the fundamental forces of nature. It's something that's so striking to scientists that it demands explanation. And it seems to me that Arno Penzias hit it right. He is the Nobel Prize winner who discovered the microwave background on which a lot of the evidence for the Big Bang is based. He said, "Astronomy leads us to a unique event. A universe which was created out of nothing, one with the very delicate balance needed to provide exactly the right conditions required to permit life, and one which has an underlying, one might say, supernatural plan." But I want to come to what I think is one of the fundamental arguments for theism. I take it this house believes in reason. That's why we're all here. And as a scientist, I believe that the universe is rationally intelligible. That is something that has struck some of the geniuses of science as demanding an explanation. Einstein said the only incomprehensible thing about the universe is that it's comprehensible. And Wigner talked about the unreasonable effectiveness of mathematics. How is it that a mathematician thinking in her head in here can come up with equations that seem to fit the universe out there? Well, how is it indeed? Because the irony of the atheist position here is evident. My atheist friends, and I have many of them, tell me that the driving force of evolution, which eventually produced our human cognitive faculties, reason included, was not primarily concerned with truth at all, but with survival. And we all know, ladies and gentlemen, what has often happened and still happens to truth when individuals or commercial enterprises or nations feel themselves threatened and struggle for survival.
So I'll pause it there for a second, interject just a little bit. So he's definitely speaking about the mathematics and the equations of how basically logic makes sense in math, and it does. However, if we haven't defined X, then X can't also define Y. So you still have to define X. Now, X might be there, and that could be God, but we can't define God. So what's the evidence you have for that? If you have none, you can't conclude then it was God. Just because you can't comprehend, due to irreducible complexity, how we all got here to begin with, which was based on survival. And that's how most of our genes happen. Now, there's also an argument that we are de-evolving as humans. And that's because we are becoming lazier, weaker, fatter. We're putting GMOs on our crops instead of growing everything organically, which is finally starting to make a comeback because we're finding out people are getting sick and developing cancers from these GMOs. So there are some changes being made and some things that are developing that are not what they used to be. Now, how we got here does not at all prove or suggest that there was anything intelligible behind it. Just because it didn't take intelligence to say, oh, we need this to protect ourselves from the sun. It was a chemical process that allowed us to protect ourselves from the sun. It was melatonin. It's the pigment in our skin. It's these things that, you know, cells die and I don't know. It's a really long process. But anyways, it's irreducible complexity. So because it's hard to imagine from the beginning how it could have happened, although we could theorize based on what we observe, it's not unreasonable, but to throw God in the mix, who we can't measure, determine, see, feel, touch, or differentiate apart from our mind or body, is a little bit absurd. I mean, that does fall into the ridiculous part. So I'm curious to think how you are also a scientist and a Christian when It's not that science is against Christianity, and I'm really tired of that whole argument. Anytime I talk with Christians and other religious folk on social media and other places, they always say that science is basically this evil enemy of Christianity. Well, actually, if it's real, and by the laws of our logic, then our God, if real, should be testable, measurable, and observable by our laws of physics. Plain and simple, that's how it should work. Now, if he can't be, then we have no way of discerning or discriminating against a thought, imagination, feelings, anything that happens in our natural world. One of the latest arguments was, how do you know where love comes from? And she worded it as, what about this spark? And I said, well, there is no like initial spark, but I guess what I'm assuming she's talking about is the chills that go down your spine, or that big thrill, or the initial impact. And it's like, well, when your body responds to stimuli, which is visual or ocular, or, you know, sensation through sound, vibration, anything that moves us, our brain reacts in a specific way. And that's through a nervous system, through a synapse that where neurons and I'm forgetting the terms, go through a chemical process and end up on the receptors that cause us to feel these things. That's why when we get a dopamine rush or endorphins or any adrenaline, those things, we have an intense sensation at those moments. But that doesn't mean it's anything divine. That doesn't mean it's anything separate. That proves that this is God and not just what we're feeling at the moment. So I have a hard time with that, saying that this is what God is, when we can't even differentiate or discriminate against what is our own actual mechanics. And that's what the brain does. Essentially, it's a mechanical system. If one part of the brain fails, then something may not work or trigger right. That's why we have people with chemical imbalances. That's why we have to develop medicine to help with mental illness. That's why we have schizophrenics that see and hear things that aren't there because the prefrontal cortex or the dorsal lateral or the ventral medial cortexes are comprehending things different from the limbic system and what is stored in the hippocampus. So if these things are affected, then your reality and perception are also going to be affected. So there's many things we can attribute to why we feel and experience the things that we do, why we have a certain attraction to the either the same sex or different sex partner, why we have an attraction to the things we like and don't like. It's all how it chemically produces an excited value based on a stimuli. That's why so many people are attracted to their phones and video games and bright colors. Like in children, you know, same thing. It's because it's inducing a chemical response process, actually very similar to doing drugs. It's not comparable. It's not the exact same type of thing because you're not adding an external chemical into the brain. It's still a natural process. However, because it's a new stimuli that is not based on our normal composition of survival from evolution, it creates an overproduction of chemicals other than what would have otherwise been a natural development. So now we're going to have to see a new shift or change happen. And we also see this happening in religion. No longer is it only about the old Bronze Age way. Now they're throwing in science and throwing in psychology and throwing in math, and how all this proves that this one factor of X, which still can't be proven by any physical evidence, is indeed evidence based on what you think of it to be. I have a problem with that because it doesn't make sense at all. It just doesn't work in our reality, because if it's operating in our reality, as it suggests, then we can measure it, test it, and observe it. Let's hear what John Lennox has to say next.
A leading philosopher, Alvin Plantinga of Notre Dame, says if atheists are right that we are the product of mindless, unguided natural processes, then they have given us strong reason to doubt the reliability of human cognitive faculties, and therefore inevitably to doubt the validity of any belief that they produce, including their atheism. Their biology and their belief in naturalism would therefore appear to be at war with each other in a conflict that has nothing at all to do with God. Yet my atheist friends still insist that it is rational for them to believe that the evolution of human reason was not directed for the purpose of discovering truth. And yet, it is irrational for me to believe that human reason was designed and created by God to enable us to understand and believe the truth.
So one of the key words that you're using is belief. Now, belief is not a system or a reasonable, rational thing that causes us to identify any evidence. It's not a system that allows us to verify if anything is actually real. We believe it to be because we can see it, touch it, hear it, taste it, whatever. Or we can believe something is real if we can't touch it, see it, hear it, taste it, you know, any of those senses. So because there's no discriminating factor between belief and in the existent and non-existent, it is not a reliable method of determining what is real and what is not. So atheists do have a lack of belief. In other words, there's a lack of evidence or any for any reason to believe in the first place that it exists or doesn't exist. In other words, it's no more different than if you were to not believe the leprechauns are real, because leprechauns are just a character in a cartoon, and we have no other reason to assume that it was real in the first place. However, God is a concept that, because it's so widely accepted as a way of life, becomes more influential on our environment, culture, and our personalities. And this is also based on, like, our families, for instance, and or where we're born. So the cultural value is much more significant when it comes to God than it does to imaginary characters such as leprechauns, unicorns, Bigfoot, etc.
Curious logic. By contrast with that, biblical theism asserts that ultimate reality is personal and intelligent, and the reason science works, and this was the motivating force that drove the great pioneers of science, is that the universe out there and the human mind in here that does the science are ultimately the product of the same intelligent divine mind.
And if that was the case, then you would have to prove that this intelligent divine mind is in fact divine. That there was divine intelligence that created us or got us to this point, or that are creating miracles above physics and law and logic, that somehow can go around that, even though it technically cannot. For the mere fact that the mere existence of even a ghost or a spirit is breaking indeed the fact our laws of logic. In other words, you cannot go around the law of logic that says something can exist in the same space of logic and law and physics, but then not exist in it. In other words, because it already breaks the observable law, or it breaks the measurable law, or it breaks the testable law. So regardless, it cannot exist. In other words, that's the same as gravity. Gravity may not be observable other than the fact that we are not floating away, and it may not be a substance that we can touch or test or whatever, but we can measure it. And well, technically we can test it if we can measure it, right? So we can drop a pen and it can fall at the same rate as everything else. We can also determine the rotation of the Earth based on 24 hours, which time is an increment of measurement, and we can determine it's going 1,000 miles an hour, give or take probably a few decimals. Then we can also determine that at that rate, at this tilt and axis and how fast it revolves around the sun, we can determine how fast something's going to fall and at what angle and what the equivalent arch is, etc. I mean, you can literally measure and test these things against different things to know that something as gravity is there. Now, what if gravity is based on movement alone? If we go up into space, we found out there's gravity in space as well. Now, we can rotate and create a artificial gravity, right? That's considered artificial gravity. So there is something that does allow a force, in other words, that we can't see observably, but we can test and measure it, that attracts us to where we are so that we don't float away. So I guess my question would be, if something is divine and from the same mind, why has it all developed naturally where it doesn't appear to have needed a mind in the first place?
Human beings are made, we are told, in God's image. And that means that science can be done. That makes infinitely more sense to me as a scientist than atheism does.
You've just defaulted to a statement that basically just says, I gave up on trying to figure this out, which isn't really very scientific.
Now, let me come briefly to ethics. Ethical behavior, like rational behavior, of course, does not itself require religious belief. This is consistent with the fact that humans are created in God's image as rational, moral persons. But just as I suggest that rationality cannot be explained without the existence of God, so I dare to suggest that the existence of morality cannot be explained either.
Actually, yes, both can be explained with or without a God, because we don't even know if God exists. We have no evidence or no proof to show that God does, in fact, hold the authority of morality in all creation, that it developed moral sense of anything. We could have developed all morals with or without God. As I know that it's not beneficial to me if I go around punching everybody in the face that cuts me off in traffic, which I really want to do sometimes, I'm not going to live a life of good and positive reward if I go around doing that. No one's going to like me punching them in the face, because our receptors, you know, when we get punched in the face, don't like it. And we have the ability of conscience, which is with knowledge, right? Or the ability to determine rightness and wrongness. We can also determine if we like or do not like something. So because we have these abilities, and because all life has this ability, we can determine whether or not something is moral or immoral. We don't need a God or an authority to tell us what it is. If you think you can't figure that out for yourself, then there is something really wrong with how you think and observe the world. And it's a very different reality. And I wouldn't say it's a very rational one to begin with. So to say that God's existence makes it more rational than one without it is still not as rational or as rational something. Then you can't say that one is more rational than the other.
As modern science sprang from Judeo-Christian sources, so did the concept of human equality. Listen to atheist Jürgen Habermas, arguably one of Germany's leading intellectuals. He said that universalistic egalitarianism, from which sprang the ideals of freedom and a collective life in solidarity, the individual morality of conscience, human rights, and democracy, is the direct legacy of the Judaic ethic of justice and the Christian ethic of love. This legacy, substantially unchanged, has been the object of continual critical appropriation and reinterpretation. To this day, there's no alternative to it. Everything else is just idle postmodern talk.
And you know, for a time, that was also modern, that these concepts were new and religion was developing. It just became popular, an adherence or collection of people that all had the same views and the same philosophy and the same desires decided to connect. We're symbiote beings. We want to connect with each other. That's the other thing. We're not designed to all hate each other and go kill and murder just because we can. We just think that because that's all the negative stuff we hear. We think that everything that we hear, even though we don't discern all the time negative from positive, is ultimately all the news that's going on in the world. So especially Christians, think that the world is ending and doomed and that the end of the world is coming soon. You know, a lot of people saw the red moon and they thought that was a sign from God or some biblical sign. But that's just the thing. It's not real. It's not true. When you think that religion holds the key or holds the ultimate authority on morality, then it's not actually moral, because there is no authority over right and wrong. This is something that has to be learned, mistakes, ventured into. Sometimes we have to learn what is right and wrong for ourselves. That's why you are supposed to be slapped on the hand if you're going to attempt to pull the handle of a boiling hot pan with boiling water in it. Without these triggers and without these survival instincts and nervous systems that we have developed, how do you know what is moral or not? Simply, somebody without an empathetic portion of the brain can commit a lot of narcissistic type crimes, sociopathic and psychopathic, going around killing everybody. Or sociopathic, destroying someone's work or job or without even thinking twice about their family at home, just for a promotion. So all of it is postmodern talk. And at some point, someone said, let's alter this. Let's change this up and let's make this a little bit different. And what do people believe? That's where the fault is.
And it seems to me he's hitting the core of something important, because the value of a human being on which sits egalitarianism rests is based not on what the human being can do, but what she's made of, or how she's made in God's image. I never forget speaking on one of my many visits to Russia to a colleague in the Academy of Sciences. And he said, "You know, John, we thought we could abolish God and retain a value for human beings. We found we couldn't. And we murdered millions of them." And Alexander Solzhenitsyn has said, "If I'm asked, why is it that 60 million of my fellow countrymen were sacrificed?" He said, "The answer is, we have forgotten God."
See, I would think you would have forgotten all rationality, what the point was to begin with. If God was real, you wouldn't have forgotten about him. But the reason why you've forgotten about God was because you realize he's really not a factor or part of the equation.
Science, of course, marvelous as it is limited. Even a Nobel Prize winner, by analyzing a cake, cannot tell why it was made. But Aunt Matilda, who made it, can tell you. She can reveal it to you. But if she doesn't reveal it to you, you'll never know. And that brings me to be my next evidence. It's the same with the universe. We can analyze it magnificently. But ultimately, if it has a maker, and I believe it has, only he can tell us what it's all about.
So here's what I find interesting. You're a scientist, but you also claim to be a Christian. Now, you're also a mathematician. You think that because there is no explanation other than what we're able to figure out, that science hasn't gotten there yet, that just because of that, as if it's never going to get there. Now, you got to know it's never going to get there and that it's never going to evolve beyond where it is. But you assume that because it's not, that God can fill that gap and all of a sudden there is a creator and that's how it happened. But we don't know. And once again, you're falling into the same confirmation bias. Now, as a scientist or mathematician, you should know this. We still haven't defined X.
And he's done so in the powerful narrative of the Bible. In particular, in its analysis of the problem with humanity, not simply in terms of behavioral breakdown between people, but a vertical breakdown of trust between us and the Creator. The unique solution to that problem is not simply in terms of human ethical development, although that's very important, but in terms of something far deeper altogether. The restoration of the fractured relationship with God through the salvation he has brought through Jesus Christ. A radical relationship that empowers us to live ethically from God.
All right, so one of the problems I have with a relationship with Jesus Christ is we also don't know who that is either. We don't know which Jesus was being talked about. We don't know if it was the Jesus that was the same one that talked with John the Baptist. We don't even know if John the Baptist existed. We just don't know these things. So we don't have, how do you have a relationship with something that you don't know exists, that you don't know is real? Well, you can feel you have a relationship, but I can do the same thing with my imaginary friend. And once again, we're back at the circling conundrum or a paradox that we don't know. We can't differentiate or discriminate against if it's imaginary, if it's our thoughts or our feelings. We have nothing that discriminates it from anything else other than any other imaginary figure or person that we create. The only thing that makes this more real is the fact that there is a collaboration of many people that believe this same thing. So you have an adherence or a collection of people that all believe in the same thing. However, everyone could have a slightly different description of something, and no one could have the same one because we don't even have that information or descriptions.
And here we reach what for me is the chief evidence, not only for the existence, but the nature of God. It is Jesus Christ. He it was who not only taught the golden rule, but embodied it, fed the hungry, healed the sick and suffering, and welcomed society's outcasts, brought honor and respect to the marginalized and ashamed.
Mother Teresa also did the same thing, and we all know how that turned out. She thought that ultimate suffering meant that that's how you got closer to God, so she allowed people to suffer in very poor conditions. However, everybody references her when it comes to doing good things in the world.
And he's brought forgiveness and peace to multi-millions around the world.
And he still allowed many to suffer and many to die and many to go hungry and with disease and not have provided any information or even a ounce of evidence to show how important it is that we believe in him so we don't go to hell. What a condition when this world is the only one that we live in that we know of because we can measure it and test it. But yet the one after it, we have no idea. So we're supposed to live this world for that one that we have no idea of, but it's supposed to be real, and it doesn't even make sense logically that he would create something so that we could make all these bad choices for him to be angry at us. Like, would you make a creation so you can be angry at it? So that it could defy you, and then you could be like, oh, fine, you're going to hell. Ha, ha, ha. Like, no, you wouldn't do that. And I know I wouldn't do that. So why would a God do that? If a God is supposed to be more moral and more objective than I am.
He's able to do this, of course, because though he was a man, he uniquely never was only a man, but God become human. The central evidence for this startling claim is, of course, his historical resurrection from the dead that launched Christianity in the world. This is, of course, ladies and gentlemen, a crunch issue. If Jesus rose from the dead, death is not the end and atheism is false.
No, atheism still wouldn't be false because you're now assuming that atheism is another religion or a belief system that we don't believe in. Now, if there was evidence for him dying and resurrecting, then yes, we wouldn't be able to really go very long saying that we're atheists and that there's no evidence. Because then there would be evidence if we could test it, measure it, and observe it, even for ourselves, which is kind of what we're proposing. Now, again, if Jesus died, that was supposed to be an ultimate sacrifice. He should have remained dead. To come back isn't a sacrifice. By definition, by the explanation in the Bible, that's not a sacrifice. Again, we still don't know that this actually happened. And if it did and was so great, how come not everybody in the world heard him? How come not everybody in the world has a document saying that at this time and this day, we all heard a strange voice in the sky? We don't have any evidence such as that corroborating that. If God is so perfect, why doesn't he just change every word in the Bible? Why doesn't he make every word in every Bible, no matter where it is, change so that it is one message from one God? Why hasn't that been done? There are many more miracles that could happen that would be a lot more realistic to a miracle than anything else that we have ever seen.
If Jesus did not rise from the dead, Christianity is false. And I remember at Cambridge as a student listening to the brilliant Sir Norman Anderson, a legal expert, going through forensically the evidence from his legal perspective as a brilliant lawyer. And he said at the end of it, "The empty tomb then of Jesus forms a veritable rock on which all rationalistic theories of the resurrection dash themselves in vain." Just finally now, as I read the Bible, I do not only find intellectual satisfaction, but I find a great deal of that. I sense the voice of God speaking to me. You say, that's intensely personal. But ladies and gentlemen, we've been asked tonight about belief in God. And I want to strongly emphasize that God is not a theory, he's a person. And if the origination of me qua person is a personal God, then the most exciting thing really is there a possibility of getting to know God?
So how do you know God is a person if no one has seen him and no one can see him? And if you do see him, you die. And if Jesus was the Son of God then and lived here on earth without any sin, then he didn't live as us. So what was the point? Why would a sacrifice even be a point? Why does blood magic come into it? Why does any kind of sacrifice of any kind of thing have to come into play for sins when he could simply go, "I forgive you. And I forgive everybody else because, you know, you're all human. It's only human. You're only acting on natural instinct half the time. And you're trying to do the best you can living through life. Sometimes you make mistakes. Sometimes you make very bad choices. Sometimes it's conditional. It's not everybody wanting to hurt other people. Usually it's because you've been hurt first. So it goes against psychology. So now you said you had an intellectual conversation, or at least you read the Bible and you feel intellectually, you feel it's intellectual and you feel like God is speaking you to you through it. Now, what you're describing is a schema pattern. Those are very familiar with when you see like a bee, and then you see the first song that pops up in your shuffle is a bee, and then your friend is wearing a bee shirt, and then they give you or then you're watching TV and all of a sudden there's like this bee commercial or something. First thing that pops on. These are schema patterns, and it happens all the time. But that's what you're describing. It's psychological. You think that it's talking to you because it's kind of like a self-help book. It's almost like the writer is writing to you, or in a way that you, because you believe this is real, that's how it sounds. That it must be a message directly to you. This concept was also in Mighty Max, when Virgil would always talk to Mighty Max through different signs and meanings, and it would just pop up in a sign somewhere or in a place, and he'd go, "Oh my gosh, that's, I got to go to the other world," or whatever. I mean, this isn't any different. But that was make-believe, and so was this.
And so I don't simply believe there is a God. I've come to know him and trust him, and I have strong reasons for doing so.
So if that's what it takes to come to know, get to know somebody and know something, then all you've done is actually gotten to know what your thoughts are. It's another version or duplicate of yourself and how your mind works. It's no different than what a schizophrenic does. They get to know the voices in their head, or the hallucinations they have, or the people they make up. Only their brains are using their prefrontal cortex to actually manifest it into more of a reality of actual hearing it, like you and I are listening to this podcast. So you haven't really experienced God.
Because of Christ dying and rising again for me. And that has generated in me a sense of utterly unmerited forgiveness, acceptance, and peace. That has enabled me to face the ugly side of my own nature, and with God's help to do something about it. But it's enabled me to face something else. The hardest problem I face as a Christian is the problem of evil and pain.
Well, that's pretty dark, because evil and pain are subjective, and pain is physical, and suffering is necessary for life. Without it, we wouldn't be able to make the decisions or comprehensions that we do. How do we determine if we're having a good life or a bad life? How do we measure any of it if we don't have the polar opposites, if we don't have any scale of which to gauge it on? Evil is also a concept that if you were to place it in a box and you were the only one in that box, let's say a room, okay? What evil can you commit? Evil is subjective to the other person perceiving what your act is. Is it necessarily evil, or is it just an act of positive or negative reward? What is determined to be evil? Now, the Bible describes it as everything is an attack against you. Just the mere fact, if I were to see you in person and question your belief based on what I know and rationality, you would go, this is an evil attack from the enemy or the devil or demons. But I can assure you, I'm not possessed by any of them. This level of thinking was something that was so long ago that we know that ghosts aren't real. We know spirits aren't real. We know that all these things that happen are not supernatural phenomena, but are now natural phenomena. We know that tornadoes and hurricanes and everything are naturally created and not supernaturally created, which at one time used to be the belief. There was also another belief that cats were gods. There was another one that Jesus was originally a volcano, or God was a volcano or something. And we know that's not true anymore. We also know that the sun is not a god, and that used to be thought as a god. The sun and moon gods would fight, and every day that's why the sun would come up and the moon would go down and whatnot. And that was a battle that happened daily. But we know that's not the case. We also know that the sun and moon could not have stood still as commanded in that one story of the Bible. Oh gosh, I'm totally forgetting which one that was. But anyways, we know it couldn't have happened. So evil and pain is a concept made up that of which people want to avoid. They want to get away from it because it's hurtful, it's painful, and that's why you have heaven that has none of that. An absolute polar opposite promise that none of this will ever, suffering, pain, sadness, all the stuff we don't like will ever be in heaven. And that's because it is hurtful. It is It makes us feel weak and inferior, and no one likes that. But that's a part of life, and that's something that you have to embrace. Something that if God really was existent would tell you to do. Because that's how we learn, how we grow, and how we evolve into better beings. That's how we know that without Hitler killing tons of people, we would know we don't like that. Otherwise, we'd be completely oblivious to it. We also wouldn't know that housing whales in a cage is bad. But without that, we wouldn't have known how smart they really are. These are some of the same teachings that Buddha does. And it's all about the yin and yang, or the without the hard work of a farmer troughing through the field, a dung beetle couldn't survive. So there's all these reasons for having pain and suffering. But Christianity wants to get rid of that. That's what heaven is. But it's very necessary. So although there's polar opposites, this is what the mind does, they made it into two places. Everything terrible and evil, even in the slightest, goes to hell. Without any objection, without any moral subjectivity, everyone goes to hell. But if you believe in this one thing, regardless of what you do, you go to heaven where there is no pain, suffering, or otherwise. But that doesn't hold anybody accountable. It has nothing to do with the works you did on this earth. You could have killed tens of thousands of people and still go to heaven. Yeah. So somewhere the moral accountability just got tossed out the window.
My niece getting a tumor at 22 that kills her. What do I say to my sister? And this is the hardest problem we face. But it seems to me that atheism here has no answer.
Actually, I would explain it's a normal part of life. To live this life as best you can. Not to worry about what is happening with the tumor or what's happening with cancer, but continue to live as best you can. Instead, Christianity is just like, well, that sucks in this life. I guess this life is a crapshoot, but hey, there's heaven after this. Or hell, depending on if the person with cancer actually believes or not. Again, we have no evidence for either, so it's just a crapshoot. So that's the hope you're giving, a false one. Rather than one that says, we're here with you, now. And we're just going to do the best we can to make the most of it. It's a part of life. Because we don't teach that these things are a part of life, we put such a stigma on them, and it becomes this huge trauma that, well, it is traumatic. It's not, that never goes away. That doesn't reduce just because whether God exists or doesn't exist. But we can work on this. We got to stop teaching that pain is a bad thing, that suffering is a bad thing. We got to stop hovering over our children and worrying about every little scratch they get. Let them get some scratches. Let them get a little bit effed up, you know, playing in roughhousing and stuff. They're going to learn they don't like that, or they're going to keep going. It's going to drive them. So, yeah, as atheists, we do have an answer.
Because by definition, atheism believes that human death is the end, so there is no ultimate hope. But you see, ladies and gentlemen, we could stay here till midnight and beyond arguing, as has been done in this university for centuries.
No, there is no ultimate hope, because an ultimate hope just means that you're making something up. So here's how we figure or believe that, based on information and evidence that we do know, of how and why what happens after you die. Well, for one, we don't worry about before we were born, because that is no different. And if you believe what God said about reincarnation, or I'm sorry, the Bible said about reincarnation, and God knew you before you were born, then that's reincarnation. Why aren't we concerned with that? Why don't we have any memory? So when you go and take anesthesia, when you're getting put down, basically, you don't have any dreams. You don't have any thoughts or memories. That's because your brain is physically shutting down. If you had a soul and a conscience, and that's where dreams were made and how that worked, it would be a lot different. And we actually know there's four different types of sleep. There's REM, deep, and light sleep, and awake. Okay, different kinds of sleep. we also know that in those different kinds of sleep, we have different kinds of dreams and different types of things. Technically, in our deep sleep is or REM sleep is the only time we actually dream or know that we're dreaming. Every other time, it just goes by quicker. But that's why under anesthesia, you feel like you've only been asleep for 3 seconds. That's because our brain is shut down and there is nothing happening after that. That's why we assume that when we die, that's how it happens. And quite honestly, I'd rather be laid to rest, having my mind at ease, and not worried about a heaven or hell than anything else. Because then it involves a lot more other arguments and other things that are not yet provable. So not only is it immoral to go around telling everybody these things are real, but you're also giving them hope, which is a false hope, telling them that these things are real, of which are never proven, and causing emotional and other suffering and damage, doing the exact same thing you claim to be afraid of or to have problems with in Christianity.
What a good God should, might, would, could, if not, possibly might, just could he not have done, and we'll get nowhere. So it seems to me there's another question we can ask, and it's this. Granted that life presents us with a double picture, we see some beautiful things. We see some ragged edges. We see hurt and pain, and we see joy. How can we come to terms with that? And it seems to me here is no simplistic answer, but a window into an answer, and it's this. If it is actually true that Jesus is, as I believe him to be, the Son of God, then we can ask the question, what is God doing on a cross? And the answer comes back at the very least. God has not remained distant from our human suffering, but has become part of it. And the other side of that is this, because Jesus rose from the dead, he is going to be the ultimate judge. Now here's an irony, because atheism has no ultimate hope of justice by definition. The vast majority of people in the history of the world have died without justice and will die without justice. And if death is the end, then of course they have no hope of ultimate justice. But the promise in the New Testament, guaranteed by the resurrection of Jesus, is that he is to be the judge in the coming day.
Because you think that there's an ultimate judge or an ultimate death, an ultimate everything, you're making up terms that you again fulfill by using God. There is no need for these things. It goes against all natural and spiritual or anything that we have. The whole idea of a God or of a spirit is simply due to the fact that there has been a thought that it existed. And ever since then, that thought has been carried on to everyone else and has been put in as, well, because you can't prove it, then it must be real. Because you can't prove it's not. That's where you make the mistake, assuming that there needs to be an ultimate judgment for our lives, for our entire life, that there needs to be an ultimate reason for death. And there doesn't. It's just a natural part of life. Now, that is much easier to accept than that there has to be a reason for it all. Because the only reason why we think there has to be a reason for it all or a purpose for it all is because we have put that purpose there by thought, not led by any evidence or source that suggests a reason to. In other words, you mentioned a cake analogy, and a scientist can't figure out why the cake was made. Exactly. We can't figure out why the God was made. We don't even have a God to see. So we accumulate this thought based on what we see the earth is or other things, and assume that because we can't create it, it must have been a form of life more intelligent than us. But that's not how naturalism works.
So, ladies and gentlemen, those are some of the reasons why I believe that God is real and worthy to be trusted. Thank you.
So that was John Lennox, and that was the video from Professor John Lennox, Does God Does Exist, with 383,000 views. And this was published in December 21st, 2012. Now, like I said, most of my arguments for this is that God does not exist because we don't have the evidence. Everything that he used in this particular forum was all based on the premise that you believe it to be true. Not that it is, not that there's evidence to support it, but believe God exists. And it goes off the premise, I think, therefore I am, or I think, therefore it is. That is not an existent God. That is a made-up one by the imagination or the brain. And this has only been happening for thousands of years. I want to thank you for listening today. Be sure to check out my Facebook page at The Adam Paradox, and also on Twitter, The One Adam Paradox. And if you would like to show your support for this podcast, please check out anchor.fm where you can donate. And I'm also looking for new material and new things to talk and discuss. Feel free to drop a line, let me know what you think, and give me your reviews of my podcast, what I can do to improve, or what material you want to hear. Also, I'm looking for new guests on the show, so if you're interested, drop me a line at the anchor.fm, my Facebook page, or my Twitter feed. I'd be glad to have you on the show and discuss some of these different topics.